Last night, President Obama announced that he would speed 30,000 additional troops to improve the situation in Afghanistan. But Greg Mortensen thinks building schools might help a lot more. Mr. Mortensen's 2006 book, Three Cups of Tea, One Man's Mission to Promote Peace, One School at a Time, has spent over 140 weeks on the New York Times bestseller list, and now he's followed it with Stones into Schools, Promoting Peace with Books, Not Bombs, in Afghanistan and Pakistan. Both of them chronicle his efforts to educate girls in some of the most remote and inaccessible places in the world. Greg Mortensen is co-founder of the nonprofit Central Asia Institute and founder of Pennies for Peace and the recipient of Pakistan's highest civil award, Sitara e Pakistan. Stones into Schools is published by Viking, and I'm very pleased that it brings Greg Mortensen back to our show. It's a pleasure to see you again.
Well, thanks, Lonnie. Great to see you again.
In this new book, you express surprise that so many Americans have been so generous in supporting your mission to build schools for girls in rural Pakistan and Afghanistan. Why wouldn't you expect Westerners to care about this cause?
Well, what surprised me, Lenny, was over the years, especially recently, even after the recession, or I guess we can call it a recession.
We can call it a very serious recession.
Both liberals, conservatives, people in the military, people of all different political backgrounds and different types of faiths have been very supportive of our efforts. So I guess not so much surprise, but it really reaffirms that Americans were really good people.
And they're not confused by the fact that we're engaged in a war in Afghanistan?
Well, maybe a little bit, but I think also I think there's more realization. I get hundreds of letters from people serving in the military, and they pretty much reiterate that without education, nothing will change in a country like Afghanistan.
You write that you personally can't stand speaking publicly, and I hope that this isn't making you too uncomfortable.
Oh, no.
And hobnobbing with the rich and famous, thank God I'm not that. But how much time do you actually spend spreading the word and asking people for money?
Well, I'm in Afghanistan and Pakistan about 4 or 5 months a year for the last 17 years, and then I spend another couple months on the road. In the U.S., I visit about 100 cities a year, and I do sometimes 200, 250 talks a year. So I spend over half the year not being home in Montana.
And you said 14 to 15 years in Pakistan?
I've been working there for 17 years now.
So how many schools have you built this far?
We've set up 131 schools, 58,000 students. We also run another 60 schools that are in refugee camps, or they're maybe, say, transitional schools in areas of conflict or areas of natural disaster, which I think is very important because often kids who are in those camps, they have a lot of downtime, and it's very important to give those kids something to do and have an opportunity to have hope while they're in a refugee camp.
And you have others currently in the works?
Yeah, we have about 40 schools more in the works. We have proposals for over 800 schools, so we've got a very lots of work to do.
You told the story about what drove you to build your first school in Pakistan in great depth in Three Cups of Tea, but perhaps it would be a good idea just to give us a recap.
Three Cups of Tea, what it first means, Lenny, is that an old village chief once told me that if you really want to do business here, you need three cups of tea. And he didn't just mean you sit around drink tea and have peace, but it means that the first cup you're a stranger, second cup a friend, and third cup your family. And what it means is about building relationships. It's a story about how I went to K2 to dedicate. My sister Krista died from severe epilepsy. I went to K2 to climb the mountain to honor her memory. I didn't quite make it to the top, and this is back in 93. Coming off the mountain, I was befriended by some local communities. They nursed me back to health, and so I made a promise, very rash promise back in 93, that I'd help them build a school, and that's kind of where it got started.
K2 is the world's second tallest mountain, but the most dangerous one to climb.
Right.
So that was a really difficult feat, or attempt anyway, and then you decide to build a school, which I assume you also thought might be the most difficult project you'd ever undertake in your life.
Well, it was quite. It took 3 years. I made a lot of mistakes. We had physical obstacles. I also had a fatwa issued against me, a decree.
For what reason? Hadn't you drunk your three cups of tea?
I did, but
were you being a Westerner and saying, okay, let's get to the bottom line?
Well, exactly. I was micromanaging. Also, the local imam, he did not want a school in his village. He wanted to keep the people illiterate. So over 3 years, the community fought the fatwa, and finally it was rescinded by the Shariat, or Islamic Court of Law. I also had to deal with corrupt government officials. We had to deal with natural disasters. But finally, 3 years later, school got built. And the reason we were able to get the school built was because of Haji Ali, the village chief, who took me aside one day and said, if you want to build a school, you have to sit down and be quiet and let us do the work.
Now, that was Pakistan 17 years ago.
Yes.
Who was Zia-ul-Haq still?
That time, that was Bhutto, Benazir Bhutto, and I've been working under all the different presidents.
Well, how much of a presence do they have in these remote areas?
Not very much. The central government is pretty much limited to the more urban areas. People also in the very remote and tribal areas very seldom see benefits from the government, so they're pretty much on their own in these rural areas.
Now, there was concern that you were teaching kids in general or you were teaching women?
The concern was that we were helping educate girls. And so I actually sat back a little bit, let them take that fatwa to the Shariat court. And what happened, and eventually in the ruling that came back, is it said that in our Quran, education is encouraged for all children. And what this man is doing is in the highest principles of Islam. So we give our support for his endeavors.
Although the locals saw this as disruptive because it challenged old traditions in the area. And how do you get around that?
Well, it takes, for me, it just took a lot of persistence and patience. I also, having learned from my father a big lesson, that my father in Africa, in Tanzania, set up a hospital, but he always insisted on having local people in charge and also empowering the elders. So I tried to do the same thing where we put the elders in charge. We also let the people pretty much do the work on their own. And it's more about empowering people rather than telling them what to do.
My guest is Greg Mortensen, whose latest book is called Stones into Schools, Promoting Peace with Books, Not Bombs in Afghanistan and Pakistan. It's published by Viking. This is WNYC, WNYC.org. I'm Leonard Lopate. So what did the people tell you women should be taught?
They said women shouldn't go to school. They're chattel. They should do work in the fields. This is not right that women should be educated. However, these are some of the despot modes. However, there's also most women were pleading and begging and said, please help us with schools for our children. That's pretty much wherever I go, the desire for education is very fierce.
Well, what is your strategy for convincing communities that schools might benefit them?
Well, we use all types of strategies. Our staff sometimes will even ask, determine, you know, tell an imam, how many goats is this woman worth if she doesn't have an education? They might say 5 goats. How many if she has an education? They'll say it's 10 goats. We also we've developed programs that show where female literacy reduces the infant mortality, where it decreases the population, where it decreases the maternal mortality. And so by equating these, even though they're illiterate people, they can realize that there are profound benefits from education.
Now, last night, President Obama said that he was not interested in imposing American values and control. And let's listen to a little bit of that speech.
Taken together, these additional American and international troops will allow us to accelerate handing over responsibility to Afghan forces and allow us to begin the transfer of our forces out of Afghanistan in July of 2011. Just as we have done in Iraq, we will execute this transition responsibly, taking into account conditions on the ground. We'll continue to advise and assist Afghanistan's security forces to ensure that they can succeed over the long haul. But it will be clear to the Afghan government, and more importantly, to the Afghan people, that they will ultimately be responsible for their own country.
Now, the president said, I'm repeating, that it will be clear to the Afghan people and more importantly to the Afghan government, more importantly to the Afghan people, that they will ultimately be responsible for their own country. And you say you don't want to give Afghans and Pakistanis an American education or teach them to think like Americans.
Where schools, the curriculum is very standard with the country. Also, however, we have by fifth grade that the kids learn five languages, including Arabic and English. We have the elders come in twice a week and do storytelling. I think one of the great tragedies that education brings is it eradicates a storytelling tradition. These are where children learn about their folklore, their culture, their heritage. We have hygiene, sanitation, nutrition classes. But again, these are all run by the local communities. And with regards to President Obama's remarks, although he said that ultimately the Afghan people will be in charge, during the nine meetings held to determine about more troops, nobody bothered to consult with the Afghan people. There was a lot of meetings. They were held behind closed doors in secrecy on Capitol Hill.
Didn't he speak to Hamid Karzai at one point?
Well, he spoke to Karzai, but the real power, or say the real integrity in Afghanistan is the shura. These are the elders, and these are the wise men. And every province has a shura, very revered and respected. And I really feel it's important that their voice be heard. And I've spent a lot of time talking to shura. And unfortunately, when this decision about more troops was made, there wasn't any consultation with the shura. I do know the military has met with some of the shura, but overall, I mean, there was nobody from Capitol Hill spending time with the shura to ask the people there, what do you want and how can we help you?
So was there anything in the plan that the president announced last night that struck you as particularly helpful in the long run?
Well, I do know that I think the military has gone through a tremendous learning curve over the last few years. I think in many ways the military really gets it even more than our political leaders and some of our State Department. Some of their keys or goals are that they have to build relationships. They need to listen more. About a third of the troops over there are, what do you say, trainer troops. These are agriculturalists, agronomists, horticulturalists, dentists, veterinarians, and their goal is to help what I call more with brain power than firepower. So, and that is a big benefit, or at least that's what the people there appreciate. On the other hand, just escalation of troops, it will evoke more violence in the long run. There's going to be more conflict. There's going to be more U.S. soldiers killed. Unfortunately, Vice President Joe Biden was recommending was to pull troops but do more targeted, selected bombings. But the problem with bombings is that you kill civilians, and you also can't bomb if you don't have intelligence. You need intelligence, so it's a little bit of we're in a very difficult position in Afghanistan.
Well, won't the troop surge help you do your work in Afghanistan because it will also secure certain areas?
Yeah, Lenny, it will help us in some areas, and in some other areas, regardless of whether there's troops or not, we're able to continue our work because we have relationships with the shura. And I do think—
Is there resentment? There are some parts of Pakistan where you worked for many years where any American is considered a force of evil.
Oh, certainly. And it takes many years, and in some areas— just in order to build a relationship to enter an area, it might take us a decade. But once we have those relationships, that's really, I think, the key, or we say the chubby, to get into the region. And I think something else that's happening, at least from my perspective on the ground, is that people are more and more resenting the Taliban. The Maulana Faisal Rahman, who's the firebrand leader of the MMA, the extremist coalition. Even he himself, he's in Pakistan in the tribal areas, he himself has denounced the Taliban. Now, this is a guy who goes around, you know, saying death to America and other things, but even himself, he has declared that the Taliban are, there should be a fatwa issued against the Taliban.
Do people in the area make a connection between the school, if they appreciate the school, and the fact that it was largely funded with money from this country?
I think so. And most, the Taliban have bombed or destroyed in Afghanistan about 850 schools in the last 2 years.
Any
about,
of yours?
None of our schools, and about 650 in Pakistan. But what's interesting, as you mentioned, is that nearly all the schools have been set up by outside contractors. Nobody knows who got the money. And one thing that we do insist on when we put in a school is that we provide the teacher training, the materials, and the skill labor, but the community has to provide free land, free resources, or free sweat equity, and say 2,000 to 5,000 days of free manual labor. And what that does is it gets the local buy-in. And one of my, you'd say, perhaps suggestions or maybe even criticisms of the recent Senator Lugar, Senator Kerry bill, which appropriated $5.2 billion of humanitarian aid to Pakistan, is there's no contingency built in there to get some type of reciprocal agreement from the country, or that the people themselves had to come up with some type of mutual, you know, investment in that fund.
Do you get any money from the Afghan government or earlier from the Pakistan government?
No, we've never taken or received any money from any government, the Afghan, U.S., Pakistan government. We have had considerable help from the various governments with some logistics, but we've never taken any money from any government.
Well, Pakistan gave you its highest award for your humanitarian services, so it's obviously appreciated on some level.
Maybe I could sell that for a couple $100, the award.
Is there ever any resentment expressed? Have you found yourself at odds with either of these governments?
I have, in that sometimes, especially at the national level, there's considerable corruption in both countries. And in order to work around the corruption, it's very important that we have local community support. And so we have had, Lenny, we have had some challenges, and but we try as much as we can to get the communities involved so that they can leverage and kind of be responsible for their own governments.
My guest is Greg Mortensen. His follow-up to his bestseller, Three Cups of Tea, is Stones into Schools, Promoting Peace with Books, Not Bombs in Afghanistan and Pakistan, as a foreword by Khaled Hosseini, and it's published by Viking. We will continue our conversation after we take a little break. Stay with us. We're back with Greg Mortensen, whose latest book is Stones into Schools, Promoting Peace with Books, Not Bombs in Afghanistan and Pakistan. It's published by Viking. And this book focuses largely on your efforts of building school in Afghanistan after half a decade of work in Pakistan. Why did you decide to go to Afghanistan in 1999? That's when the Taliban were in power, weren't they?
Yeah, we got a request from... I was at this very remote pass in northern Pakistan. A dozen Kyrgyz horsemen, the Kyrgyz is an ethnic group, came over the horizon, and they had come from Afghanistan. And kind of a scene out of the Wild West, where, you know, I'm from Montana, and they asked me for help to build a school. So I made, a rash promise that day and back in the fall of 99 that I'd help them build a school. So that's kind of the narrative, the arc of the book is... the fulfillment of that promise to the Kyrgyz horsemen.
Was it very different than working in Pakistan?
To some degree, Afghanistan is more, I would say, is a warrior culture. And the title, Stones into School, is part of the folklore. If you spend time with a veteran or mujahideen in Afghanistan, they'll invite you to come and sit on their roof and serve you some green tea with a little sprig of mint in it. And then they'll look up at the mountains and say, do you see those boulders up there and those stones? Every one of those stones is a shaheed or martyr who died fighting our enemies, the Taliban or the Russians. Now we must turn those stones into schools and make their sacrifice worthwhile. So I, the title of the book is in honor of the Mujahideen and the fighters of Afghanistan.
It's kind of like swords into plowshares.
Something, yeah, like that.
You say that you like to build schools according to a last best place philosophy. Where does that expression come from?
That's a Kitteridge quote, and it's meaning that most organizations tend to start from an urban area and work their way out to the rural areas. We do it the other way around. We start in the most volatile or remote or extreme areas and then work our way back to the city.
And you write that you had to build many more schools before you could build the original school in that Wakhan corridor for the Kyrgyz. Why?
It was because we had to build relationships. I remember I was sitting in Capitol Hill in February, and they wanted to see a map. I didn't have one, so I took a blank piece of paper, and I started writing in names of all these different people. And Congressman leaned over and asked me, he said, okay, now where are the cities here and the roads? And I remember another congressman leaning over and said, you know, when Greg looks at a piece of a map, he does not see names of cities, but he sees people, and it's about building relationships. And I never, you know, I was the first time I really thought about that the way we actually work is building relationships with people.
Now, this area is not just volatile on a human level. There are also earthquakes. What impact did the 2005 earthquake have on your efforts?
Well, it was a very devastating earthquake. In Pakistan, 2.8 million people were displaced, 78,000 people died, 18,000 of those were children in school. Fortunately, none of our schools were really affected by the earthquake, but we did go into the area immediately after the earthquake and start setting up temporary schools in tents, and now we've established 29 schools in the earthquake areas of Pakistan.
You've talked about how you talk to the local legislative groups about what they want. Do you speak to the girls who will be attending these schools about what they would like to see, what they would want to learn from going to the school?
Yeah, that's one of the favorite joys I have or delights is to talk to the young women and girls and ask them what they want to be or what their hopes are for the future. And what education does is it actually makes their dreams and hopes become a reality. Some of the young women, they want to become a policewoman. Some want to become teachers, nurses, lawyers, doctors. Fozia is now one of our students in Azad Kashmir. She became the first female out of 4.2 million people to pass her bar exams last year, the first female. Another woman named Shakila from Baltistan in northeast Pakistan is the first female physician out of 1.2 million people. And so we're starting now to see the maiden generation or the first wave of literate women and how their lives have changed and what they're doing with their education.
You mentioned in the book a lot want to become maternal health care workers, that like midwives?
It's like a midwife or maybe LVN/EMT. And the reason for that is that the maternal mortality rate is so staggering. About 2,000 women die out of 100,000 live births. That's extremely high. In the U.S., that would equate to about 17 births per 100,000 live births. And so a lot of women aspire to become maternal health care workers. And just with a little bit of training, for example, one valley called Charpusan, in that valley before 2000, 5 to 20 women died in childbirth. A woman named Aziza went to 2 years of training. It cost $800. She came back in 2000. Since then, not one single woman has died in childbirth. And this is just one woman. What she's done with her education has probably prevented about 50 to 100 women from dying during childbirth.
And you report that women tell you that they want two things, for their children not to die and for their children to learn to read. And it doesn't matter whether they're boys or girls? I would think that if there was so much resistance initially, that despite the wonderful stories you tell about people going to law school or going to medical school, that there are people in these communities who are saying, that's just too ambitious for a woman.
Well, it is, and it's very difficult, and especially for the first wave of literate young women. However, over time, and I've now been able to, I've spent 17 years working in rural areas, the first women who have become attorneys and physicians and nurses, they become role models. And so over time, those stereotypes start to erode. But as you're right, it's very difficult. It takes time. And sometimes it might even take three or two generations. It doesn't happen, rapidly.
What is the literacy rate in Afghanistan?
In Afghanistan, it's about 26%.
And does it vary for male, female?
For females, it's about a third. And the female literacy rate is probably between 12 to 18%. In the urban areas, probably more like 50%. In the rural areas, it's sometimes often in the single digits, like maybe 2 to 5%.
And what language are they learning to read?
Well, in our schools, they learn five languages, Pashto, Dari, which is Farsi or Persian, Arabic, English, and then they speak their native tribal tongue. There's various tribal tongues. And one thing we insist on, though, is that they not only learn how to read and write Arabic, but understand Arabic, and that is the key. In many of the extremist madrasas, the children are taught by rote and memory how to read Arabic, but they don't know what they're reading, and then they can become incited or indoctrinated. So we not only teach the kids how to read and write, but understand Arabic. And when they can understand Arabic, they realize that there's nothing in the Quran that prohibits girls from going to school.
Now, you're in some areas where the Taliban remain very strong. How do you live with them? Well, do they tolerate you?
They tolerate us. It varies. The local Taliban, or I could say in Afghanistan, the local Taliban, they don't really bother us. However, there are, I say, outside Taliban, foreign Taliban who've come in from other countries, and Al-Qaeda, who are very opposed to our schools. But we do some fairly unusual things. We've hired some former Taliban to teach in our schools. May seem controversial, but they have become our greatest advocates for education. And they're on death lists by the Taliban. They don't want them around. What's interesting is most of those men got out of the Taliban because their mothers said, what you're doing is not a good thing. And it was their mothers who insisted that they get out of the Taliban.
So as there's more education, there's more of a desire to not engage in terrorist activities or violent activities?
Well, in some cases, and I think, again, it starts from the mother. When a woman has an education, she's much less likely to condone her son to get into violence and to terrorism. And I saw that happen after 9/11. The Taliban, actually, they had a high desertion rate, but they're primarily targeting illiterate, impoverished society because many educated women, including today, refuse to allow their sons to join the Taliban. But obviously, that's not all-inclusive, but it can be a strong deterrent.
Well, what was it, 13 years ago, you were kidnapped by the Taliban, weren't you?
Yeah, 1996. For 8 days, I was held. I was kidnapped in Waziristan, which is where some of the recent kidnappings have taken place. It was right at the beginning of the Taliban. It was quite frightening. I first came very depressed, and then after 2 days, I realized that probably my only way to get out of there was to befriend my captors and start to talk to them. I then asked them to bring a Quran and share their faith with me. And then I also know that in their culture, that the birth of the firstborn son is life's greatest event. So I told them that I needed to go home to watch my son being born. Now, I ended up having a daughter, but that did really win them over. But eventually, after 8 days, they did release me, and they even gave me 3,000, or say 10,000 rupees, which is about $300, as a kind of a token donation to what I was doing.
So that was a Taliban in Pakistan?
In Pakistan.
We are told that there are differences between the Pakistani Taliban and the Afghan Taliban.
Yeah, and I'd say in many ways now, I spent 2 days at Camp Lejeune. I visit about 24 military bases a year. And the Marines at Camp Lejeune were sending some of their senior NCOs and officers to embed with gangs in L.A. and in the U.S. because they said that fighting the Taliban is more like dealing with a mafia rather than, classical insurgency. And I can say, that the Taliban, to me now, are more like a criminal element. They're involved in extortion and crime.
And drug trafficking.
Drug trafficking, illicit lumber trafficking, kidnapping and extortion. And people perceive them not so much as a monolithic, strong entity, but basically criminals and thugs who are committing, atrocious things against the people.
Do you see a lot of poppies growing where you are?
In some regions, yes, Lenny, especially in down in Oruzgan in Helmand Province. There's still some also opium growing up in the north in Badakhshan Province. It has curtailed, however, the stockpiles are still really great. And recently the DEA is touting the success of the anti-opium eradication programs, but there still is huge stockpiles that are remaining in warehouses.
Hasn't it been much more difficult for you to do your work in Afghanistan than in Pakistan?
In some ways, in Afghanistan, the physically more difficult. In Pakistan, there's been more unrest and volatility in some of the regions. So,
have you been in the tribal areas mostly on the border with Afghanistan?
On both sides of the borders, and I'd say it has gotten tougher. On the other hand, we do have more and more relationships, so I guess there's kind of a benefit to, having drank, let's say, tens of thousands of cups of tea. There is some benefit to that.
I've heard that 3 cups of tea is required reading for all officers in counterinsurgency training. If you could write a book addressed specifically to them, to these new soldiers who are coming in, and the ones who are still a bit confused about how to deal with the problems in Afghanistan, what would you write? What would you tell them?
Well, I could summarize it up in one of their commanders, General David Petraeus, the CENTCOM commander, read 3 cups of tea. And he said that there were 3 important points that he had gleaned from the book that he wanted to impart with the troops. And being a military general, he summarized them in 3 bullet points. So I think that's probably the easiest way to summarize it. But he said, 1, that we need to listen more. 2, that we need to have respect, meaning that we are there to serve not only the good people of the U.S., but of Afghanistan. And 3, that we have to build relationships. And I heard General Petraeus interviewed on public radio about a year ago, and he was asked, what should be our top priority in Afghanistan? And a very serious kind of question, and he kind of chuckled. He said, well, we need to drink more tea. And
you think that's happening?
Oh, I definitely think so. I know that between Admiral Mike Mullen, General Petraeus, Admiral Olson, the 3 of them have been in Pakistan, Afghanistan more than 3 dozen times in the last year, and there's definitely been a lot more emphasis on building relationships.
Greg Mortensen will be giving a talk tonight at 7 o'clock at Hofstra University in Hempstead. For more information on that, you can go to our show page at WNYC.org. You have a website that people can check you out on?
Yeah, just 3cupsoftea.com or stonesintoschools.com.
And the latest book is called Stones into Schools, Promoting Peace with Books, Not Bombs in Afghanistan and Pakistan, published by Viking. Thank you so much for being with us again.
Thanks, Lenny. It's an honor to be with you.
On tomorrow's show, William Eggers suggests ways Americans can renew their trust in government. And then comedian Howie Mandel discusses his lifelong battle with obsessive-compulsive disorder. Also, director Jen Thompson and actress Mary Bacon on a new production of Sidney Howard's classic 1931 play, The Late Christopher Bean. And also, our latest underreported segments. The Leonard Lopate Show is produced by Blakeney Schick, Stephen Valentino, and Julia Corcoran. Melissa Egan is the executive producer, and we have help today from Stephanie Bernhard, Colin Adams-Toomey, and contributing producer Virginia Doris. Debbie Fountain was at the audio controls. I'm Leonard Lopate, your host. Thanks for listening. We'll see you tomorrow.